We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Nancy K. Miller. She is one of the most distinguished academics you will have a chance to hear from, and she's also the author of What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past, an autobiographical exploration of her family throughout the generations. Let's keep going, because you started by telling us earlier in the show the story of kind of what triggered this, which was basically unclaimed real estate being sold and finding pieces of your family in Memphis and where they led you.
Right. My first cousin was much older than I was, and he was quite ill, and the only thing he wanted to talk about was himself, which was a whole other narrative. But he did mention in passing, in the most casual way, that his father had worked for the Jewish gangster Dutch Schultz, who was known as the Dutchman. And I truthfully had to go back and look it up on Wikipedia when I got home, because I didn't really know very much about Dutch Schultz, but it turned out he was known to be the beer baron of the Bronx. So according to my cousin, my uncle...
This, of course, during Prohibition.
Yes, exactly. And Prohibition actually plays a funny role in this story, which, if you can remind me, we'll get. I'll make the link.
So, okay.
Anyway, so he described how my his father would ride along in a horse-drawn carriage with these, you know, kegs of beer, and he would deliver, and that was, you know, that was part of his job. The other part of his job was collecting mafia money, or whatever it's called, protection money from various businesses.
Extortion is what they call
it.
Yeah,
well, I guess that's what it might be called. And he took the money. He would take these little packets of money to the Cotton Club, which is a very famous club in Harlem.
Right.
And he would deliver the money there. And so that story, I was absolutely. It was so. I lived in a, grew up in a very bourgeois, very, very legalistic family. My father was like a stickler for everything. And the idea that he had a brother who delivered money to the Cotton Club in Harlem was pretty surprising. And I wasn't really sure if I should believe him. But later in the visit, I went out with Sarah and this my cousin's ex-wife, and they confirmed all these details, and in fact, were very proud of the story. That was my first piece of Kipnis lore, that we had this uncle who had worked for a gangster.
It's a great story.
Yes, I was quite floored.
So he was kind of a bag man for Dutch Schultz, if you really want to put it in the local
parlance.
Well,
I guess that's right. I mean, what I was going to say is that there's a wonderful novel by Doctorow called Billy Bathgate.
Yeah,
that kind of traces the history of this boy who worked for Schultz. And it was actually very helpful to me, because I began to see, you know, how it could have happened that my uncle would have been, you know, involved in this.
Oh, for sure. So you also had a relative, as you continued to trace your history, who had perhaps a little more illustrious beginning, became a mayor.
Well, guess what? It's the same person.
Isn't that funny?
So in 1934, in the summer of 1934, or somewhere thereabouts, Sam moved to Arizona, and the reason was supposedly, and I think it's true, that his son Julian, my first cousin, had asthma, and he was actually quite ill. So Sam and his wife and this child moved to Tucson, and according to I have a second cousin by marriage who lives in Tucson, Brownie Ebner, and she reckons that he came from the east with money that was that Dutch Schultz had given him,
kind of a
stake.
Since
that was right after repeal, in other words, I mean shortly after repeal. So he came and he bought a cafe called the Shamrock, very Jewish name, and it was a tiny little postage stamp town. I mean, I think it was like a mile long. I mean, he and four other property owners gathered together and petitioned to create, to incorporate South Tucson as an entity. And that led to his being elected to be, and I have this clipping, which is now in the archive, that says, Kipnis elected mayor of South Tucson. So that actually turned out to be an incredible, importantly, a very important piece of information, because it led to an archive. Because he was part of this movement that went on for decades, by the way, because Tucson, the city was not happy. They really wanted to annex this little tiny part of town. And so the struggle actually went back and forth for several decades. But that was his original claim to fame. He became a local celebrity. It was written up in the Arizona Star. And I really got a sense for the first time of what the personality was of this person, whom, as I think I said, I never met.
He must have really been a character.
I think so.
And of course, I should note that it's his Brownie. That's his daughter, right?
Brownie is his. I'll see. Oh, let me get this genealogy straight. Brownie is his niece
his
by
niece.
Marriage.
Okay. Well, it is a complicated genealogy. I'm looking at it, and I'm still not getting it right. So, you know, as you continued on this process, you know, you didn't just stop with the colorful figures. You really traced out the whole history of the family and the experience. You hadn't really, obviously, you're an academic, you're a trained researcher, but this hadn't been an interest of yours to a degree before, had it?
It's true. I mean, I was dimly aware that I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family, because the maternal family was huge and invasive and engulfing. And if I ever did ask my father anything, he either fell silent, or one time, this turned out to be kind of important for the book, I once asked him a story about growing up on the Lower East Side, and he started to tell the story, and his eyes welled up. He was a bit sentimental. But my mother interrupted him, and I never got the story. And it was kind of like there was some blockage about telling the story. So once the phone call came and I began to look, I saw that there are other ways to go. I mean, and the most important, there were so very many little clues, but what started to fascinate me was a photograph of my grandparents and Sam, the same Sam, who was an immigrant, a picture taken at a studio in Chisinev, which is now called Chisinau. It's now the capital of Moldova, but right. At the time it was just Chisinev in Bessarabia.
And you talk about the Chisinev pogroms and how they were sort of the Holocaust for Eastern European Jews until the Holocaust.
Yes, and I'm happy you brought up the pogrom word, because what I've found when I give talks on the book, or I see my book described, it's very often people assume, and maybe you found this on the show, that if you say Jewish, they think Holocaust. It's very hard to get people to think back to this incredibly important wave of immigration that went on, that there were 2 million Jews who emigrated between 1880 and 1924, when the Exclusion Act was published, decreed. All those people, all those immigrants, you know, now end up with someone like me, my third generation, trying to reconstruct the history that they didn't tell. And so, but the fact that I had this photograph, that's why Sam played an important role, because I could more or less judge his age, and according to what he looked like, this picture had to be taken around 1903. They didn't leave until 1906. And the area of the pogrom was so small, the pogrom was so important, that there's no way that these people did not see the pogrom. I mean, that's
right.
That I'm convinced of. And I also did a huge amount of research on the pogrom, because it is the first pogrom that was photographed, and it was also internationally reported. And there's also a famous Hebrew poem written about it. So that I began to sort of attach myself to a kind of a history of an entire generation of people, and with a certain experience that I had absolutely seen as something very, very, very remote. And suddenly it seemed close. And that, I think, was part of the biggest surprise of the book, and how close I felt to the immigration experience and to this particular history.
You know, you tell or retell the famous Baal Shem Tov story about, the Baal Shem Tov used to go to a particular place when trouble threatened the Jews and pray to God in a particular forest at a particular time, and it works its way through the generations. Tell a little bit about how that story affected you.
Well, one of the things that I struggled with doing the research was, what my relationship to Jewishness was. In a way, it was, I had not, as long as my parents were alive, as long as my father was alive, it kind of was something that I took for granted and I didn't know very much about. But then, as I learned the history, I became very attached, to it. And the when I found out that my great-grandfather and my grandfather had actually been born in Bratslav, I became aware of this Hasidic writer, Nachman of Bratslav, and who was a very famous storyteller. And so in the process of doing that research, I came across the Baal Shem story about what happens to, the way I understood it, the way it seems to circulate is that there's a generation that believes in the prayers, says them, they go into the woods, they go to pray. And then there's a second generation that performs that experience without actually going into the woods. And then there's the next generation that retells the story, and they don't do any of the rituals. And that, I think, is what, that story felt very powerful to me, because what I came to feel was that I felt that I wanted to tell this story, not just because it was my story, and then I'm an autobiographer, but because I realized that it was really the story of a generation, a sort of post-pogrom, post-assimilation. There was nothing left to assimilate, it was really about a return to stories that had been lost and experiences that had been lost. And so any time I could find a trace of the previous generations, especially if I could find something in writing, which I did, it was very moving to me and very, I had a sense of renewal, even though I was so, buried, I wasn't buried, but I was so involved with the past that, and with dead people and people I hadn't met and people I felt very sad that I hadn't met because some of them I could have met. But then I had a sense for myself of a kind of reconnection with a history and lost memories. And so that's why that story, that's how I interpret the story in any event, that there is a kind of retrieval possible, a kind of return possible through this excavation of stories.
Well, it's a great story, and obviously we advocate that return here on Too Jewish. The book is called What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past by Nancy K. Miller. It's a great piece of research, but it's also a great read, and I encourage you to look it up. Nancy, thanks for a great visit here.